So I'm pleased to kick us off with the first talk in the Buddha in the Pali Canon series. And it's a pretty well-known sutta, the Meghiya Sutta. Most people have heard of it. It's from the Udana, which is one of the earliest Buddhist texts, actually, the Udana, and from the Sutta Pitaka. Those of you here last week and had your little maps of the Pali Canon that I gave you, you can see whereabouts that is in the Pali Canon. So it's from the discourses basket of the Pali Canon. And yeah, Udana means out-breath or inspired utterance. There's various renderings, translations of Udana, but it's about out-breath. At the end of all the stories, there's always an inspired utterance right at the end from the Buddha. He just sort of comes out with something right at the end, having given a teaching. So in January this year, I gave four talks on the Meghiya Sutta, four full-length talks on a retreat in Vajra, India, a Mitra retreat. So there's quite a lot to say from such a short little sutta. If you actually look it up in the Pali Canon, it's just a three or four pages or something like that, but it's quite condensed. There's an awful lot teaching in that little sutta, and it all arises out of a young man, ardent man, who's a little bit headstrong. There's some very good teachings for us in the Meghiya Sutta, which we can use. They're very relevant for us today. In fact, we've just been doing one of them. We've been practicing meditation, metta-bhavana, and that's all included. So it's quite a good story. So I'll tell you the story of Meghiya. So the Buddha was staying at a place called Chalukya Hill, which I've tried to find it and on Google Maps, but I can't. But somebody I read on the website said it's somewhere near Lumbini. Somewhere near Lumbini, and it's not called that anymore. But anyway, so it's what was northern India and what is now Nepal. And Meghiya was a young monk who was the attendant of the Buddha. You might remember that the Buddha had lots of attendants throughout his life, and the most successful was Ananda. But he had a number who was very, very good attendant, looked after him, made sure he was okay, and arrange things for him. But he had a number of not very good attendants before Ananda finally turned up much later on in his life. And Meghiya was one of them. He was one of the not very good ones, I'm afraid. But there we are. So one morning the Buddha was sitting, probably in meditation, probably contemplating whatever he was doing. Meghiya was supposed to be with him. So he approached the Buddha, saluted him, sat down at one side, which is the sort of traditional, a bit like when we were going, if we were going to see a teacher, you know, it's a little bit formal, isn't it? And what he did was he requested the Buddha to go to Jantu village. Again, I tried to find Jantu village and couldn't find it, but it was a nearby village, and he wanted to go into Jantu village on his arms round to get food. This is the morning, so presumably he got food for himself and for the Buddha, and went into the village, and the Buddha said, yes, off you go, Meghiya. And he returned later. Presumably they ate the food. So this is all pretty standard stuff that goes on at that time for the Buddha. He then saluted the Buddha again and requested that he could go for a walk. Could he go for a walk? So he'd had his food, and he didn't say, would you like to come with me, or anything like that. He just said, I'd like to go for a walk now on the banks of the river Kamikala. I'd like to go for a walk. He's had a bit like we might do. If we've had a big meal, we might want to go for a walk. So he went for a walk along the banks of the river to get a bit of exercise. And that's all that was happening, really. But while he was walking along the banks of the river, he happened to notice a really wonderful mango grove just sitting there. And he thought, wow, wow, look at that mangrove grove. Wow, what a wonderful place to practice meditation. Fantastic, it's so beautiful. If I was in there, if I could get Lee to go there, I could really make some progress. It's such a wonderful place, it's really well set up. And so he was really inspired to go to this place, and couldn't contain himself, came back, approached the Buddha, and asked for permission to go to the mangrove grove. He said, look, I found this wonderful place for meditation. I want to make progress. I want to go. I want to leave you now and go off on my own. He didn't ask the Buddha whether the Buddha wanted to come with him or anything like that. He just wanted to go. And the Buddha said, well, actually, Magia, I'm on my own. And stay here for a while. It'd be better if you stayed here till some other monk comes along to be with me. So Magia wasn't really satisfied with that. He wasn't really happy about that. And he asked him a second time. He said, no, look, I really want to go. It's a wonderful place. I want to make progress with meditation. If I go there under these conditions, I can make progress. And again, the Buddha said, well, not really, because I'm on my own here, aren't I? And you know, you're supposed to be looking after me. And let's wait till someone else comes along to be with me. And Magia wasn't satisfied, and the Buddha had this, he had this rule, didn't he? If someone asked him three times, yeah, he would give it to them one way or another, whether they liked it or not. And so Magia said to him, look, it's all right for you. You're the Buddha. You don't have anything more to do. You've gained what you need to gain. You've trodden the path. What about me? I need to make progress, and here's an ideal opportunity for me to make progress. So the Buddha said, well, what can I say? What can I say when you put it like that? Do what you think it's time to do. And he was off like a shot, and crashing off into the kind of mangrove grove to do his meditation, left the Buddha where he was. And so he set himself up with his practice, obviously thought, right, we're going to make some great progress here. Here we go, off we go. But actually it didn't sort of go very well for him. It was quite surprising. There he was under these conditions. He's got permission. He can go, perfect conditions. It doesn't go very well for the Magia. He spends the whole day meditating in the mangrove grove, and he's assailed, the texts tell us, by thoughts lustful, thoughts of hatred, and thoughts of cruelty. Very interesting. And he's quite surprised. He's really, Magia's a bit shocked, really, that the hindrances are so strong and quite particular to him, that he works, you know, he's working away in the mangrove grove as hard as he can with his meditation, trying to kind of get out of these hindrances into something much more creative. But he doesn't do it, he doesn't make progress at all, and he's quite surprised. And eventually, as the evening draws near, he gives up and he goes back to the Buddha. He comes back to the Buddha a bit sort of crestfallen, I think, really, because he was so ardent, so full of enthusiasm. So it's a bit of a surprise for him, really. And there he is back at the feet of the Buddha. And he tells the Buddha all about it and what's happened and how it's been, that he's been assailed by thoughts of lust, hatred and cruelty. So the Buddha then gives him a teaching. This is what the sutta tells us. He said, okay, you know, you've been defeated by the hindrances. I've got a teaching for you. And it seems that Magia was receptive to the teaching at this particular time. And this is what he says to Magia. He says, when heart's release is immature, Magia, five things conduce to its maturity. What are the five? And without reading out the whole sutta, he then goes on to enumerate five particular conditions which will lead to Magia's insight and eventual enlightenment, or what the text refers to as the heart's release. Well, the first one is something that we know all about. It's spiritual friendship. Effectively, he's saying you really need the basis for, if you really want to make progress, you need spiritual friendship, Meguia. But of course, Meguia's got spiritual friendship right in front of him in the form of the Buddha, but of course, he hasn't seen that. The second thing he says is you need an ethical life. You need to practice the precepts, Meguia. That's your foundation for everything. He also enumerates what he calls talk on the Dharma. They didn't really do Dharma study in those days, because of course they didn't read and write, they didn't have text to study, but they did talk on the Dharma, they discoursed the Dharma. So the Buddha's recommending this as an essential condition. And he then talks about applying the mind in meditation, and he's talking about effort generally in spiritual practice. You need that as a condition, you need effort. You need to be able to apply yourself in the right way. And fifthly, he talks about insight as a condition, and particularly insight into the rise and fall with the mind that penetrates the perfect ending of dukkha. So he then goes on to say, towards the end of the sutta, it says, he talks about lust being overcome by a sugar bhavna, or contemplation of the unlovely. Hatred is overcome by metta bhavna, which is what we've just been doing, of course. Discursive thought is overcome by mindfulness of breathing. And ego clinging is overcome by consciousness of impermanence. He then gives the final verse of uplift, which I personally find a little bit kind of slightly uninspiring. I think it's just the translation from the Pali into English isn't that brilliant, but you'll be able to get the gist. So this is the Udana that he gives Meguia right at the end. Trivial thoughts, insignificant thoughts, when followed, they distract the mind. Not understanding these thoughts, the roaming mind runs back and forth. But by understanding these thoughts, one ardent and mindful restrains the mind. An awakened one has to overcome them completely, so they do not arise to distract the mind. So that's it, that's the pith teaching that he gives Meguia at the end. So that's it, that's the story of Meguia, that's really all it is. There's a lot packed in there, of course, a lot to talk about, but it's quite a straightforward situation, really. So that's the story. So young, inspired, attendant of the Buddha, gets a bit individualistic and distracted and wants to go off on his own and pursue enlightenment. Even though he's got an actual, real living embodiment of enlightenment right next to him, who he's supposed to be looking after. But he's not listening to him. Then comes back, having failed within his meditation quest, comes back to the Buddha, and is actually receptive to the Buddha, and receives some teachings. So that's really what the Meguia Sutta is. We don't really know what happened to Meguia after that. There aren't any suttas that refer to him, any other kind of suttas. So we assume he made really good progress. I think he would have really been a fool if he hadn't made progress after getting such great teachings from the Buddha, from such painful experience. But I think we can assume that he made progress and made his way all the way to enlightenment. And he'd probably have realised, probably with a bit of embarrassment and humility, that he'd really got a wonderful friend. He'd got the first condition there of Kalyanamitrita, of spiritual friendship, right in front of him. There was a very wise and very kind person in the form of the Buddha. He was a very, very good friend to him. But of course, he had really kind of fully seen that. I think the mangrove grove itself is, and the symbol of the mangrove grove is quite an interesting place. I don't know about you, but this definitely happened to me many times. I've, in my travels in the world, in Britain, retreat centres, I've often thought, wow, look at that place. If I could go there, if I could meditate there, I've definitely had that experience. A few years ago, I was in Kalimpong, the Himalayas, and again, because of Bhante's association, and I found this little monastery, and just for a little afternoon, I was kind of entertaining the idea of kind of spending more time there, because that's where I'd make progress, and it seemed very, very attractive at the time. But probably it was just a distraction. I was inspired, but it wouldn't have been enough. But these hindrances seem to have particularly caught him off guard, and there's a commentary written by a 6th century monk called Acharya Dharmapala. Not Anagarika Dharmapala, he was much later, this is a different Dharmapala. And according to this commentary, he's got an explanation for why Meghir had such a rough time in the mango grove. According to him, it was all to do with Meghir's previous lives. He had spent several lives back, he'd spent quite a lot of time in the vicinity of the mango grove. In fact, he'd been a Raja, he'd been a king in a previous life. And he'd got some weighty karma from his previous lives. And the text says that he had enjoyed himself with many dancing girls on the very spot of the mango grove. Doesn't give any details, it's just probably a good thing. So he'd got some kind of weighty karma in that regard. But also, he'd spent quite a lot of time executing dacoits on the very spot as well. Dacoits are bandits in India, they're still called that in India. And he'd obviously rounded up dacoits and executed them on the spot. So in this very spot in a previous life. So that's the explanation that's given. So that probably explains the intense craving and also the cruel thoughts. I don't know whether it really explains the hatred, but, you know, we'll let that go. But he had weighty karma from the previous life. I had a little bit of an experience of this myself quite recently of weighty karma. I went on holiday to the Lake District about a month ago. I grew up in the Lake District, and I visited an old slate quarry, which I worked in from the age of 17 to 19. So it wasn't actually a previous life, but it was a long time ago, so it feels like a previous life, actually. And I worked there with scores and scores of men in the middle of these mountains in a big slate cutting plant. And I worked in a garage in a pit, kind of working on trucks and vehicles and changing oil filters and fan belts and all the rest of it. And anyway, I went and visited it with my son, my brother. And it's all completely gone. Everything's gone. There's no trace of it. But we did find a little bit left of the pit that I worked in. And it was just like a kind of Wild West ghost town with just a few ruined buildings and everything's been abandoned. And there's me, standing in what left of the pit. It's sort of partially filled in. But when I was 17, I worked in that pit. And for like 2.5 years, sort of servicing these vehicles. And it felt very weighty when I was there. Because though nothing bad happened, I didn't do anything unskillful there or anything. It must have been quite weighty because I'm 60 now and I still occasionally dream of I'm in that slate quarry. I'm still there in that slate quarry and all the buildings and all the people are there. But when I actually stood there, you know, it's nothing there. Everyone's, probably most of those people are dead. But it felt quite a kind of weighty moment. Not everybody believes in rebirth. But certainly that's what the Buddhist tradition teaches. And it teaches that weighty actions from or experiences from previous lives can affect us at a particular time. And that seems to be what's happened to Meghir. It looked like a wonderful place to go and meditate, but actually there were other factors going on for him. So I'm going to say a little bit about, just a little bit, not very much really, about the five factors, and then I'll conclude. But before I do that, I want to tell you another story, actually, again, from my own life. when I was a Mitra, when I was 24, that's 36 years ago, I was quite an ardent Mitra. I was a little bit like Magia, actually. I really was, in a way, I was quite passionately involved in Sri Ratna. I'd been quite discouraged by my involvement in other Buddhist movements. And when I found Sri Ratna, I was really, really keen and involved. And but also, I was an artist, and I'd not long been out of art college, and I was obsessed with the history of art and particular artists, and well, in particular. And one of these was Pablo Picasso. I was obsessed with Pablo Picasso, his work, his life, and all of it. It was very, very important to me at the time. I liked a lot of artists, but particularly him, it was very, very important. But I did have a friendship with one of Bhante's attendants at the time. Bhante's had a lot of attendants, doesn't he? He did have throughout his life. I had a friendship with one of them, Prasanna Sidhi, and he invited me down to London Buddhist Centre to see Bhante. So I was only 24. So I went to see Bhante, and he was in his flat, his little flat in the LBC. And so I asked if I could spend a bit of time with him talking about art. And so we did that. I didn't really know Bhante, and so we sat there for about an hour drinking tea and talking about art, and it was good. I really enjoyed it. But of course the big question had to come out, and I was building myself up. So after a while I said, please Bhante, I'd like to talk to you about Picasso. I've got a particular question to ask you about Picasso. Do you think that he is or was a great, great artist? What do you think? And this was quite a loaded question for me at the time. And he said, He said, okay, I'll get back to you on that one. So I waited about a month and nothing. No, didn't hear anything. I waited for 2 months, 3 months, nothing. Didn't hear anything at all. And I think that was more than 6 months. Eventually I got a letter from him, all written incredibly kind of mindfully and carefully. And this is what he said. He said, I have been thinking about your question deeply. I've been looking at the many paintings and sculptures of Picasso. Prasanna Sidhi and I have visited galleries in London. He is a talented artist, and I like a lot of his work. However, on balance, I think he was the greatest con man of the 20th century. So that's what he said. And I remember standing there, kind of in my house, sort of feeling devastated. Because my beloved Picasso, but he thought he was the greatest con man of the 20th century. And he went on to say why that was. He didn't think he was a great artist, actually, by his definition. And he suggested other artists to me that I should follow up. He was keen on Monet and Matisse in the Impressionists. He was keen on the Dutch masters, the Italian Renaissance, Turner and Constable. And he even, surprisingly, encouraged me to study Rabindranath Tagore. And that's a whole other story. I have studied the artwork of Rabindranath Tagore firsthand, but that's a whole other story. But I remember being very upset. But looking back, I do think I did benefit quite a lot from Bhante's advice on art. I think I did. And I think his definition, for me, is still the best definition of what art is. Art is the organisation of sensuous impressions into pleasurable formal relations that express the artist's sensibility and communicate to his audience the sense of values that can transform their lives. So when I heard that, I thought, wow, yeah, that's deep indeed. So my story doesn't exactly match Nagia's story, but there's definitely some parallels there, I think. First of all, Bhante considered my question quite carefully. Yeah, he really thought about it, just like the Buddha did with Nagia. And he didn't dismiss it, you know, just because I was young and foolish, he didn't dismiss that. Also, I had to wait. I had to wait quite a long time. And I had to learn, you know, I was impatient, and I had to learn patience, so I had to consider other people. Very, very important. Also, I think he treated me with respect, even though I was probably quite arrogant or, you know, foolish, passionate. And I think he kind of convinced me of something through a deeper perspective that he had. And he kindly pointed me onto a better path, I think, a better artistic path. I think I'm much, much broader in my artistic interests than now than I ever was back then, even though I'd just come out of art college. So this is just a small personal parallel that I've got with the McGeer Suitor. Perhaps you've got something of your own in your own life. I think the story is quite a universal one. It's the kind of story that a lot of people can experience in their lives. So now I'd like to make some brief points about the Suitor, and then I'm going to conclude. I'd like to say something about the five conditions, and I won't talk about the four meditations because I think they deserve a whole talk on their own. I think they're quite an important set of teachings. But the five conditions, I think, is the pith of the McGeer Suitor. And I think the Buddha has gave McGeer some really quality teachings here. He gave him like a complete path to follow all the way to enlightenment, just in five things. And so you can go a long way with this, and we can go a long way with these five things. They're probably so familiar to us that there isn't really anything new or original that I can say about these five areas. I think they all deserve a kind of Sanghamite theme of their own. Actually, you could do a whole series on each one of those. They're so deep. So I'm just going to make one little point on each one. One little point I'm going to make. And some of those points might even seem a little bit off-beam, but they're points I'm going to make because we do know the area so well. So spiritual friendship, the first, is probably the most useful of all the five points that he gives, because if you have spiritual friendship in your life, if you have a good experience of Sangha, yeah, then all the others will follow. Yeah? It's a lot more easy to be ethical if you've got spiritual friendship, you've got a strong association with the Sangha. You get a lot of encouragement in the Sangha to be ethical. And other people are being ethical. It's talked about, it's chanted. We're reciting those five precepts all the time. So it's going in all the time. So you get loads of encouragement. Also, the other thing that you get in the Sangha is, of course, you get the mirror. You get the mirror that's held up to you. Because you might think that you're really experienced and very, very ethical. And other people may not quite see it like that. You know, they see you and they'll mirror that back, hopefully in a skillful way. I remember, I think I'd been ordained about 10 years or something like that, and I was in a chapter meeting where I was asking people for feedback in the chapter about myself and the practice at the time. I remember overwhelmingly the chapter I was in, they said, "We all really like you, Saraja, we really appreciate you. There's a lot that's really good. But we do notice that you eat too much and you talk too much." and that you should sort of cut down on both those things, really. And it was put a little bit more kind of skillfully than that, but that was the essence of it. But I thought it was really good. So when I thought about it, I thought, yeah, probably you do, really. And but I hadn't really seen that, you know. It's so easy not to see your own faults, isn't it? Particularly in relation to the precepts. If you're among the Sangha, then Dharma talk, Dharma study, Dharma discussion is just much easier to do, isn't it, than it would be in normal life, because you're in the Sangha, people are talking about the Dharma, people are giving talks, there's groups, it's happening all the time, people talk in that kind of way. you can meet somebody for lunch in town and just talk about the Meghia Sutta for the whole of the lunch if you want to. I've certainly done things like that, and I enjoy doing that. So I think it's a really good thing. So being in the Sangha, you will find study easier. Same thing with effort, with virya, with energy in pursuit of the good. Everyone is practicing in the Sangha. If you're involved in the Sangha, practice is going on, isn't it, amongst you. You can see that, and that's inspiring for you. Sometimes it's a little bit challenging, but you know what to do. You know where to put your effort. So when I was a young Buddhist in my teens, I didn't really know what I was doing. I thought there was a period of time, quite a long period of time, I thought the principal area that I should be putting my energy into, my effort into, was learning Tibetan. I remember I thought, oh, if I could learn Tibetan, could really understand the Dharma, I could gain enlightenment. That's how misguided I was, really. I didn't really have much guidance. I needed someone around like this kind of Sangha, but I didn't have that then. If you're among the Sangha, then insight will be there. It may not be perfect enlightenment, people may not be wearing badges, but wise and kind people with a lot more experience will be around for you to access and hopefully help you and even inspire you. They will be there, they will be around in the Sangha. So I think spiritual friendship within the context of the wider Sangha is really crucial. And it's the central point of the five conditions, I think. But the four other conditions require a bit of attention as well. So I'll just say something, not very much. The five precepts, so ethics. As I say, so much has been said, but I wanted to make a particular point about ethics. By practicing the precepts, we purify ourselves. Yeah, this word purification, Buddhist word. By doing that, we become dependable, we become skillful, and we become strong. We know ourselves through practicing the precepts, and others can rely on us, others can trust us. A corrupt man or woman is actually quite weak when you think about it. We can't trust corrupt people. The character is flawed. And there's a lot of that going on in the world. There's a lot of corruption. Politics, business, religion, the media, it's full of corruption. It's going on all the time. I was reading recently that the UK, in terms of trustworthiness, in terms of trusting our central institutions of our country, the UK is the fifth in the world. It's the most trustworthy country where citizens feel they can trust their government and their institutions. You wouldn't always think that when you put the news on or whatever, or read a newspaper, but apparently it is. And the most trustworthy country in the entire world is Austria, according to this poll that I read. India, where I regularly work in the Dharma, is the 78th most trustworthy country in the world. And, we know, don't we? We know what it's like in India. You can't trust things very easily. You've got to double-check everything all the time. It makes life very, very difficult. So to live compassionate and wise lives, we need trust. We need to trust ourselves. We need to be able to trust others. We need to be able to trust society. So ethics are crucial here. And we can define trust as consisting of two things: character and competence. So character means your ethical intention, you want to do the right thing. Yeah, your motive is good. That's your intention, that's your character. Being a trustworthy person. Competence means how skilled you are at something. Yeah, how skilled you are in your practice. Do you know yourself well? Are you integrated? Can you manage yourself well? Are you skilled in the precepts? So you need these two things. You need character and you need competence. You need skill. And I think this trust definition applies to Dharma life. I think it also applies to worldly life too. I'll give you an example. In 2014, I went on a pilgrimage. I went to the Himalayas. If you go into the Himalayas, the only real way to get there is by jeep. And you have to go through some enormous mountains, passes on jeeps. And sometimes when you look over these very narrow, crumbly paths, you can see jeeps hundreds of feet down, crashed, everyone's been killed down in the bottom. It's dangerous, actually. Himalayas is dangerous. And when I first went there, a friend of mine, Gina Palata, said to me, when you choose a jeep driver, he said, go for somebody who's middle-aged. Don't go for somebody who's young. Go for somebody who's middle-aged. So we spent quite a lot of time, myself and my other pilgrims, finding the right jeep driver, because we met lots of very nice people that had very good character. They're very happy to take us. They weren't going to con us. They seemed all right. But they were young, and we didn't know whether they were skilled. But the middle-aged man that took us seemed pretty skilled, and so we were okay. These things didn't matter. Good character is not enough. Good character is, having good intentions are not enough in Buddhism. We also need to be skilled, we need to be competent as well. It's not enough to know and chant the five precepts. Yeah, you actually need to be skilled in them as well. And in order for people to trust your advice, like maybe trusting the advice of the Buddha, you trust the advice of your spiritual teacher, you need to be able to trust their understanding and their skill in relation to their practice. Dharma study or Dharma talk. So only one little point to make here, I think, is just a little bit of advice Banti gave me, actually. Me and quite a number of other people. I was very lucky enough to do a week's study with him in 2008. And we studied a text called Buddha Mind. And it's very, very good. Somebody asked him the question, how do you go deeper in Dharma study, Banti? How do you actually do it? Come on, give us a tip, kind of thing. How do you really do that? Do you have to be a scholar? No, he said, you don't have to be a scholar. He said, what you really need to do, if you really want to go deeper in Dharma study, is choose three or four texts. And just choose them and focus on them for the rest of your life. Could be the Dhammapada, could be a Triratna book, could be one of Dante's books, but take that text and read it regularly, study it, go on retreats with it, go on a retreat specialising in that particular text, but get to know it absolutely thoroughly and deeply. Don't worry about anything else, he said, just do that. Go for depth. They said if you do that, two things will happen. Your connection across the Dharma will deepen. Everything will deepen, your connections with all the other texts. And your general Dharma knowledge will become better and understanding. But the second thing that will happen is you'll become a resource for the movement. You'll become an expert in the White Lotus Sutra or Dhammapada or whatever it is. That will happen for you. So I've been studying and reading the Sutra of Golden Light now for 32 years, every day. And it's working. I'm definitely going deeper into the Sutta. But also I've got a couple of other ones as well. Dhammapada is one of them. So have a look. Have a look at the suttas that really inspire you and interest you. And keep rereading them, reflecting on them, studying them, and you'll go deeper. That's a suggestion. Motivation, energy and effort. I think I've only got one point to make here. We often don't have so much energy for Dharma life, as much as we could have, because so much of our energy is unfortunately wasted. By wasted, I don't mean useful and enjoyable things like time with the family, recreation, creative activities, writing, relaxation, but I mean more addictive and trivial things. It's addiction and trivia that we've really got to watch out for, because they leech away our energy. So the sort of thing I'm talking about is, too much TV. Got a little list here. Twitter, Facebook, WhatsApp, YouTube, Instagram, Tumblr, Snapchat, LinkedIn, Pinterest, Viber, MySpace. I mean, all these things didn't really exist 20 years ago, but now everyone's kind of very, very involved in them. And if you're not careful, you can spend hours and hours and hours a day on these activities, and then you wonder why you haven't got any energy for down the line. So I'm not being a killjoy, I use these things myself, but we do need to find balance, I think, because they can just take over your life if you're not careful. It's interesting that in the Buddha's day, they had their own version of this. They had metaphysical and cosmological speculation. Apparently, this was a really, really big problem. And because the forerunner of Hinduism, which was going on there were all these different gods. People used to spend hours and hours talking about the particular merits of particular gods and whether they were more powerful than other gods and what would happen in a fight, and all this sort of thing. And people just waste their time on all this kind of stuff. And there's often exaltations in the scriptures where the Buddha's, you know, taking quite a firm line against this sort of thing, really. So good Buddhist energy is unblocked, mindful, and with nothing wasted. So it's something to aim for, isn't it? A very good teaching in this area of efforts is what's called the four right efforts: preventing, eradicating, developing, and maintaining. But that's a whole other-ish teaching, and I haven't got time for it now. Lastly, insight, the fifth condition. And there's just one point I think I want to mention here. The Sutta talks about penetrative understanding of the rise and disappearance leading to the complete end of suffering. So we've got three things here: penetrative understanding, rise and fall, ending of suffering or unsatisfactoriness. So we're talking about knowing and seeing conditionality, prachitta samuppada, interconnectedness, the rise and fall of everything that exists in the phenomenal world, impermanence, one of the deepest teachings of the Dharma. So this is much more than seeing and understanding that universal truth that everything changes. Yeah, we all know that. We know it at some level, that we get older, people die. Flowers are there on the shrine, so apart from their beauty, is to remind us of their impermanence. Yeah, and if you leave them there for a week, they won't look like that. They'll look really messy and dried up and not very nice. And so we get rid of them and get some more. And that's what's going on in life all the time. And it's quite challenging teaching. But this is the way that things really are. And we have to gain insight into this rise and fall. We have to penetrate it and really see it and embrace it and not be fazed by it at all. And then liberation can come. So I think this teaching can be quite scary if we haven't prepared ourselves with Kalyanamitrita, with ethical practice and Dharma talk and all these good things that I've been talking about, making an effort. We won't be ready, we won't be prepared, we won't be able to experience insight. Actually, this teaching is quite scary for us anyway, because not only is everything impermanent and changing, but all things are impermanent all of the time. There is no non-change. Yeah, there's only the appearance of permanence. It's only the appearance of permanence. Everything is changing. So this is a radical and challenging teaching. This is what's meant in the Heart Sutra. We're talking about holding to nothing whatever, but dwelling in Pranya, wisdom, etc., etc. That's what Shanti, who is it in the Heart Sutra? Whoever composed the Heart Sutra is talking about. So if we embrace it, this deep and challenging teaching, together with the other four conditions that the Buddha gave Aggya, then we can be liberated. Insight and enlightenment can be arrived at. So it's worth saying, just as an end piece really, that this Buddhist centre, this beautiful Buddhist centre, with all the wonderful things that go on here, and all the facilities that we have, are here purely to promote these five conditions. That's what this Buddhist centre is here for. It's not here to make money. It's not here to kind of appear on some website. It's here for these five conditions: spiritual friendship, ethics, study, striving, and insight. That's what it's here for. And it's set up to promote what the Buddha taught Maggia. In fact, all Sri Rana centres and retreat centres exist for this purpose. That's their main purpose. It's a place where men and women can practice these five conditions. So sadhu to that, I'd say. Sadhu. So this is the story of Maggia. I hope you found it useful. My talk has come to an end, as all things must do.